You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, this is we have Craig Nelson. I may as well do the introduction. Brian Callen Show with Hunter Motz, as always. And our guest is Craig Nelson, who has written a number of books, but Rocket Men, but also The Age of Radiance most recently. It took him 5 years. And it is, you also were the, I think I read your book, the Thomas Paine, too.
Which oh, yes, great.
Book. Yeah. But The Age of Radiance really sort of traces the first time in the 1890s, I think, we discovered X-rays, and takes us all the way to the Fukushima disaster. And it's a history of
radioactivity, really. Yeah.
And how radioactivity exists in our body. It's what keeps us warm. We have a love-hate relationship. It's the angel and the devil that we have been living with for a long time here.
Yes, I really wanted to go back to the sort of old-fashioned history books where it would be a great big epic that would be covered in one volume and you could read it on a plane. So even though it tells you the details of the science, people can read it on a plane. And after all this 5 years of research, I'm so both simultaneously anti and pro-nuclear that people have actually asked me, Are any groups paying you? Are you in the pro? are the pro or anti-nuclear people paying you? And I go, well, after reading this and hearing me talk, which one do you think is paying me? So anyway.
Well that's the genius of Craig Nelson. You're getting paid by both.
There you go.
Exactly. I actually wanted to say, if anyone out there is listening, I would be happy to be paid. But anyway.
Well, you know, the reviews of the book, too, and they're dead on, just how eloquent. The you know, the writing is great with the characters and stuff.
And the details. I mean, the anecdotes, yeah. The stories. I mean, so many, you know, I mean.
It's got to feel good when you get those kind of reviews.
Well, I don't really, I think highly of my sweat labor and not so highly of my prose. So when people really love it, it makes me very happy.
There you go.
You know, one of the major things about doing this is that when you cover these characters who are previously written about as cardboard people, you know, like not Einstein, of course, has had fantastic books about him, but Marie Curie has never been really treated as a real living person. And that's true for a whole bunch of people in this story.
Yeah.
Fermi, a lot of the great Keller, a lot of the people you don't really see, like what they would be like to live next door to them with their radium glowing on the walls. So it's fantastic to sort of bring them back to life.
I think that's actually a great place to start, is to start with the Marie Curie stories, because it's so funny, because obviously nowadays we have an understanding of just how dangerous radiation can be, and the sort of the cavalier attitude with which the Curies treated these highly radioactive materials. Like, you still can't go to their shed because it's too, like, they did most of their research in the shed, you were saying, in the book, and you still can't go there.
And now the National Library of France has collected all of their materials, and they store it in a lead-lined safe in the library, and you have to wear protective clothing to look at it. Even her cookbook is so radioactive, it's dangerous for human contact.
Amazing.
And I remember as well, you told the story about they had some party, and they lit the party by just hanging these little vials of radium that would glow in the dark.
And what was fantastic was she liked to leave her radium samples out in the lab because she would get there. She would get to work before dawn, of course. She was one damn worker, that Marie Curie.
And lived a long life.
So she would arrive there, and they would be lit up with these beautiful aquatic firefly-like green glows. And everyone would comment on how beautiful it looked. But then some people noticed that when she put the radium away, the walls were still glowing.
Amazing.
So that was really almost the first sign of this.
And she ended up dying at 66 of aplastic anemia, which was brought on by our exposure to radiation, I guess. But that's a long time to live when you're working with radiation for that long.
Well, it's just amazing. Fermi only lived to 55. There's a monument in the city of Hamburg to the martyrs of nuclear science, and they have almost 400 names on it now.
Wow. And all who paid a dear price just for working that closely with this radiation.
Yeah, it really starts the mixed feeling of this. I call it the scary puppy, because someone said, you know, when you hold plutonium, it's so interesting because here's this silvery metal and you expect it to be cold, but it's warm like a puppy. But in fact, if you hold the puppy for too long at Los Alamos, the cure was high amputation. So I like to kind of think of this as a scary little puppy. And the other thing that I really enjoyed about learning the science was the fact that the entire issue of radioactivity starts with atoms that are too fat for their own good. So these atoms spit out little pieces of themselves, two kinds of particle and an energy beam, gamma rays, because they're so fat that they violate the laws of attraction that govern the material world. So you can sort of think of radioactive atoms as being like Hollywood starlets, unstable and bulimic. But they can be charming, like Hollywood starlets.
Like charming, like
Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah,
yeah, fantastic. My God, that's amazing. Yeah, and I mean that is, I mean that's so. There was so much dramatic irony in the book, especially in the first half. You know, where you're just constantly reading, like, yeah, they're holding the warm puppy, they're lighting their paths with radium. It's truly, truly stunning, and I mean, it makes sense. But I mean, you know, we just have such a fear of radiation now, and I mean, especially when you get to the latter parts of the book and you start talking about how dangerous nuclear energy is, say, to compared coal mining. I mean, I thought that was really fascinating. I mean, have we exaggerated the dangers of radioactivity?
Well, what I think has happened is this sort of bizarre set of coincidences. And there are two that happened. The first was that the United States created the most dangerous scientific experiment in history when it exploded the first hydrogen or fusion bomb in Bikini, which is where bikinis come from because they were launched with the promo, like the atomic bomb, they're small and devastating. But anyway, so they thought this was going to be a 4-megaton bomb, and it was a 15-megaton bomb with a fireball that was 4 miles in diameter, and it infected a wide range of the Pacific. It killed some island children, and then it infected a Japanese tuna boat that was on its way home, and the tuna was sold into the Japanese market before anyone knew what was going on.
Oh, man.
So the Japanese thought they were being relentlessly targeted by Americans with atomic attacks, and right after this, the two scientists released a report that they had found genetic mutations in fruit flies exposed to radiation. And they had these pictures of these bizarre fruit flies with multiple limbs and multiple eyes and all of that. And right after that, the movie Godzilla came out.
So
there's that part of the history.
Well, there's always been a great deal.
Three Mile Island. Three Mile Island happened. Walter Cronkite announced Three Mile Island exactly at the same time that the Jane Fonda movie China Syndrome was playing.
Right.
So all of these coincidences, I think, have colored our entire idea of nuclear science, nuclear power, all of it.
And nuclear power, for the most part, provided something doesn't go wrong, like Fukushima or Chernobyl, and we'll get to that, or Three Mile Island, is a very clean way to light your city and things like that, isn't it? I mean, way cleaner than coal.
It is, and I sort of wish as many people who are anti-nuclear would be anti-coal, because coal is a nightmare.
Yeah.
and something like 55% of our electricity is produced by coal plants, and 16,000 Americans die every year from pollution caused by those plants.
Well, but that's the thing. I mean, you look at those numbers, and I mean, what you do such a good job of in the book is basically the number of people who die from coal, but we don't realize it, as opposed to these very dramatic deaths from, you know, things like Chernobyl or
Bikini Atoll. Well, I think what we're reacting to is the potential.
Yeah.
So the Fukushima thing, I mean, that with those they're called gamma sponges. It's an awful way to look at it. But these men who went in and decided it was a suicide mission to open the vents.
Yes, exactly. Well, the gamma sponges is because, you know, the Japanese have a cultural history of being very interested in cleanliness. Mm-hmm. So the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who have their sort of own group, the survivors of that, they're considered unclean, almost like lepers now. And now all of everybody in Fukushima is considered by Japanese society essentially to be somewhat unclean.
I mean, talk about payback, right? You go in there, you fix Fukushima, or at least put it under control so that the entirety of Japan isn't irradiated. And in return, your society ostracizes you.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, the workers at that plant, and there were actually 400 of them who were all gamma sponging. They were sort of rotated in and out. They were really from the sort of lowest parts of Japanese society. Mm-hmm. Either they had a background in the Yakuza, the mafia, or they were really from the slums. They were like migrant workers here.
Wow.
So that's the kind of people who saved the world from ecological disaster, the Japanese society's version of migrant workers.
Explain to us what they did and explain to us just how bad the Fukushima meltdown was and what a meltdown really means, because I think a lot of people are not aware of that. And finally, what is going on now with is it leaking into the Pacific?
Well, the first part of the story is the fact that even though it is built on a fault line on the coast of interesting news to California listeners, the plant actually survived the tremendous earthquake, and it would have survived the tsunami if they hadn't put their batteries in the basement.
Okay.
So wow. The only thing they did wrong, actually, is put those batteries in the basement. And because of that, they couldn't get power, and that means the atomic reactor starts overheating.
Okay.
And when it overheats, it just burns everything up in its path, and it produces hydrogen, which are the explosions that cause it all over the place. But that isn't really the scary part. The scary part is that it melts through the floor and gets into your water supply.
Oh, boy.
So now, for those on the Pacific issue, I wouldn't be a pregnant woman eating raw tuna off the coast of Fukushima. But other than that, the ocean has this tremendous capacity of dispersing pollutants and other things, even though there is that big clog of things. And the reason why I say that is because this guy just did a tour of Bikini in his submersible trying to look for radiation. And the only radiation he found in all of Bikini, which suffered one after the next of the biggest atomic tests you've ever seen in your life, the only radiation I ever found was in the tombstones of the locals because they were made from sandstone.
Wow.
Other than that, it's all washed clean.
Well, I heard the same about Chernobyl. I heard Chernobyl didn't cause the kinds of deaths that people thought it would. Right?
Not at all. And even the UN has spent millions of dollars in decades on research, and they say that the total figure is 75, and of those, the vast majority were either plant workers or first responders, the firemen who were trying to get in there and put it out. It was a fire that lasted for 2 weeks, and the others who died were children of families who refused to evacuate the zone and who drank the milk of contaminated cows and were in the age group, which is about 12 to 15, where their thyroids were going, and they got thyroid cancer from that.
Wow.
And there's also, I mean, there was a great story that you talked in the book about where there was some employee of this nuclear power plant, and every day they kept on finding that he was radioactive, and they couldn't figure out the source until they figured out that the radiation actually wasn't coming from inside the plant. It was coming from his basement, which was essentially producing radon, and that, you know, was it Three Mile Island? Was that the story?
Yes. Well, he worked down the road from Three Mile Island, and there are many people in Pennsylvania who are convinced that they were contaminated by Three Mile Island, but in fact, they weren't. And we know that they weren't because the EPA set out testers to collect deer tongues, because apparently, if you have nuclear fallout, it immediately gets on the tongues of the deer in the neighborhood. And that's how they found out. Isn't that great?
Great. Let's go get ourselves some deer tongues, boys.
Exactly. Test those deer tongues now. Test your deer tongue in the privacy of your home.
In the privacy of your home.
But one guy who worked at the power plant next door kept setting off the alarms, and they found out he had massive. And Pennsylvania is a hotbed of radon. So all of those people who are worried about Three Mile Island, you know, the one thing I say is, well, have your basements checked first and then worry about Three Mile Island.
Right. Because the issue is just the kind of rock they have in Pennsylvania gives off radon. So it's it's a local, naturally occurring phenomenon that is a result of the geology and not of the nuclear power.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like we shouldn't so much worry about X-rays causing cancer necessarily if we get a couple X-rays here. I mean, we can, human beings, it sounds like if you're an adult, can take a lot more radiation than you would have otherwise thought.
Well, it's astonishing. The most astonishing thing I really learned in doing this whole research was that the United States and Japan have been running a joint medical survey of the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki ever since, like, 1949. So this is an amazing group. And we don't really have that much medical evidence about human exposure to radiation unless, you know, you're standing there and a power plant explodes next to you. Mm-hmm. And they have found that those people, compared to the normal Japanese, average Japanese person, have a 1% increase in cancer.
Incredible.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
And these are people who survived nuclear war, you know.
Yeah.
They
wow.
weren't just living next to a power plant. But the issue is, so the issue with these power plants is usually not fallout. Chernobyl turned out to be fallout because, I mean, airborne fallout, because that plant was designed to both produce electricity for people in Kiev, and then they converted it to make plutonium for warheads. And to do that, they had to change the roof. So it didn't have a containment dome like almost every other nuclear plant in the world has, and that's why it sent a cloud the size of 400 Hiroshimas across all of Europe for 2 weeks.
Right. That's not a reflection of, as you said in the book, it's not a reflection of nuclear science. It's a reflection of Soviet nuclear science, which
exactly.
has the goal of producing power and producing nuclear warheads.
Uh-huh. But,
and you believe that we may have seen the last days of, the, you know, we I don't think we've built a nuclear power plant in since the 70s or something.
Well,
which is unfortunate. I mean, if we want a cleaner environment, I would imagine there is a responsible way to do this.
And a lot of environmentalists support nuclear power as a better alternative to coal. Isn't that true?
Yes, it's much better than any petrochemical. So what I'm hoping, and anyone who's out there who likes to tinker in the basements, please help us. What I'm hoping is that someone will either come through with a breakthrough for nuclear that makes it both safe and cost-effective, or we will have some breakthrough in improving our renewables that make them more efficient. Because, mm-hmm. you know, right now to go to solar, you'd have to cover 2/3 of California in solar panels to go solar. And we're just not efficient enough yet, that technology.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and one of the things that I thought was, I mean, really mind-blowing is that you said in the book that, you know, Chernobyl was the 14th largest nuclear accident in Soviet history, but that essentially the 13 biggest ones were covered up, and they just couldn't cover up Chernobyl.
Yeah, it was detected by Sweden at a nuclear power plant with the same thing as that guy who was setting off the alarms in Pennsylvania. Their employees were coming in setting off alarms.
Mm-hmm.
And if Sweden and other nuclear power plants didn't have their employees tested all the time, we probably would have never known about Chernobyl.
Amazing. And how can you tell me the difference between uranium and plutonium and all the different oniums? What is, you know?
They're all different sizes on the periodic table.
Right.
So all of them are so fat that they spit out particles and gamma rays.
Mm-hmm.
That's what radioactive things are. But all of them are enormous, and atomically speaking.
Right.
So plutonium is human-made. Uranium is found in the Earth. Very little of the isotope that we use for bombs and power plants, though, is found in the Earth. So we have to enrich it. And that's actually the big secret to all of this, is not the genius brains at Los Alamos who came up with a bomb design, but the people who figured out how to enrich uranium to make fissile fuel.
That's what they mean. So it's not. It's one thing for a country to have uranium. It's another thing for them to be enriching uranium, where like Iran. So that's usually when we know you're enriching the uranium not for energy,
but you're
enriching it for weapons.
Exactly.
Okay.
The Stuxnet virus that the U.S. and Israel infected Iran with.
Yep.
That virus attacks the centrifuges that enrich uranium and cause them to commit suicide by overpowering themselves. That's what they did.
Wow.
And in general, the biggest technical challenge in terms of making a nuclear bomb is enriching the uranium rather than actually building the bomb.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
So I mean, that's the thing is that's why, you know, very often, you know, they're talking about yellowcake uranium, or, you know, in the news you hear that they're so concerned about uranium supplies, and it's basically about what would happen if they got it. Once you get to the stage of having that enriched uranium, the hardest part of building a bomb is out of the way.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, when we set up all of that, it was the biggest building at the time ever constructed to make our enriched uranium for Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. And in fact, today, I don't see how it's likely that we'll ever have terrorists with dirty bombs, because we know exactly who makes enriched uranium. Mm-hmm. We know how to track it.
Thank God. So, I was going to ask you that question, so thank God. Yeah.
So we know how to track it. However, there is an alarming idea, and I keep wondering if I should say this publicly, but but anyway, the two things that are plausible for terrorists are the fact that we have nuclear waste sitting in swimming pools, nuclear power plants all over the country, because we don't have waste disposal for that.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody wants it, right?
No one wants it, you know. And Nevada has been atomic bombed relentlessly over the course of its history. So they turned down the one that was going to be built there. But all of that stuff is just sitting around, this nuclear waste. And B, we have this extensive transportation network covering pretty much the western half of the United States of power plants and bomb facilities and bomb storage locations and all of this stuff, and it's this enormous transportation grid. So if a terrorist wants to go nuclear, that's, I think, where they would look.
Well, that was the worry in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union as well. It's just all the stuff sitting around. And if it got in the right hands, we'd be
in
big trouble.
And there's that, you have that great anecdote in there that supposedly there's some oligarch who has a nuclear weapon sitting at his dacha, right?
Yeah. And I actually didn't know if that story was true. But Bill Languishi, who's one of my most admired writers, he works at The Atlantic and The Times sometimes, he reported that, so I thought I could repeat it. So it seems a little boastful to me. Like, why would you want a nuclear weapon in your house?
Because you're Russian.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you got a handgun, you know? I got a nuclear weapon. It's all about penis size.
Listen, the Russians never had difficulty understanding the concept of mutually assured destruction. It was a pretty easy concept for them to understand.
We've come close to, I mean, what is the scariest accident we almost had?
Or the scariest time we came closest to nuclear war?
Because one of them was certainly when Enrico Fermi the reactor started to work. And they had some buckets of water, I think. And
I say my book has the three most frightening experiments in the history of science. And the most frightening was the bikini bomb. But the second most frightening was they were making the atomic bomb for Hiroshima, which is made with uranium, and they couldn't figure out how much of this uranium isotope they needed. So a guy went off into the canyons, and he set up this guillotine device. And on the one end, it would have little plugs of uranium, and at the bottom he would have little washers of uranium, and he could resize them, and he would use the guillotine and drop the plugs through the washers.
God.
And a physicist said it was called tickling the dragon's tail, because they were trying to come as close to making an atomic explosion without actually blowing themselves up.
Oh, my God. Yeah, my God.
That was a pretty dangerous experiment. And the third most dangerous experiment in American science happened when Enrico Fermi was supposed to have a facility built for the first nuclear reactor test off in the woods, in Argonne Woods. And the contractor had an employee strike. So the president of the University of Chicago said, well, you know, we have this abandoned football stadium here, since we don't play football anymore here. And inside is this squash court. And Fermi looked at it and said, this will be perfect. So the very first nuclear reactor was set off in the middle of Chicago.
Right. And they had something like buckets of water, and it was terrible. I mean, that's how they were going to put it out.
When you talk about building the reactor, I mean, essentially they're just piling these bricks on top of each other, and they hired like the football players or some like just big burly college frat dudes
with an axe.
Yeah.
Well, here are these huge greasy huge piles of uranium or refined uranium, and then these huge piles of greasy graphite, which is the moderator that slows down the neutrons so that you have a chain reaction. And so they were piling these things up, and these little nerdy physicists, they couldn't really do this. So the president again of the university again said, well, you know, we have our our guys here on scholarship, and they could, our athletes on scholarship could really use a job. So that's who they hired.
Amazing. Amazing. But the truth is that Fermi and Curie and all these people that kind of gave us this died of cancer. I mean, Fermi also died, I think, of stomach cancer. Was that tied to his work with uranium?
Well, his doctors at the time said no, but his daughter is convinced it does. And you know, it's one of those things that's the cancer you get from all this is very specific, but you have to ingest it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Okay.
So the gamma rays, like when an explosion first happened, that will get you immediately. That's like getting overdosed with X-rays.
Yeah.
So the same thing happens. And when we look at pictures of Hiroshima and Nagasaki of the results of people dying, that's from gamma rays. But the particles that these little fat Hollywood starlet atoms are too big to penetrate the skin.
Really?
So they can cause a burn on your skin, but you have to swallow them or inhale them.
Wow. So that's why you wash them off, then. That's why
that's why when you have all those scenes in Silkwood of naked Meryl Streep in agony being brushed off by men in the shower.
Yeah.
That's why.
Wow. Wow. And you have to really scrub them off, I guess. Or in the movie.
No,
the
you can wash it off.
Yeah. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And also, mm-hmm. and so, I mean, the other thing, I mean, that you mentioned as well is that Fermi had a secondary cancer in his body when he died, other than the stomach cancer, right?
And that's right. But if he had a nice fried chicken dinner in the lab and wasn't meticulous about not licking his fingers, you mm-hmm. know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's ways that all of this stuff translates. I mean, one of the amazing things was the German team, Meitner discovered fission. She was so convinced that all of this radiant elements that they had running around were interfering with each other's tests and experiments that she developed this scrupulous isolation of materials so that the counters for this experiment weren't being affected by what was going on across the room. Both of them lived to their 80s.
Wow.
God. You know, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's just amazing. How many people have died? It's hard to tell, I'm sure, with the Fukushima thing, but after the tsunami, after the earthquake, how many of these gamma sponge, I'm sorry to use that word too, but these first responders, how many of them died?
Nobody.
Nobody.
Yeah. No, but 18,000 died in the tsunami.
Yeah.
If you look at the press in the United States, you would think the tsunami was the minor incident and Fukushima was the big deal.
And none of these first responders who went in there and opened those vents, none of them have actually died of cancer.
No, unless the government and the company are covering that up, which is possible. No,
sure. They
aren't. Yeah.
So in general, would we say that it's not a good idea to locate a nuclear power plant right by the ocean?
Well, what I really feel is that we have this history of not being careful enough with these materials in various ways, such as the number of times both the Soviet and American early warning systems were set off by geese, weather balloons. I mean, these are the government calls the head of the Defense Department and says, we're being attacked by Soviet missiles. Mm-hmm. And it turns out to be geese.
You know?
that kind of thing happens over and over again.
But clearly, so, geese are an act of war.
Yeah.
Right. And then you have this situation where every time we have one of these nuclear accidents, both the utility and the government react in such an incompetent, unreassuring manner that, you know, they're evasive. They don't reveal the truth. They don't really explain what's going on. They don't appear to be keeping our best interests at heart every time we have one of these accidents.
How did the how in the world did Putin's that guy who was the former Soviet spy who died of radiation exposure and was probably poisoned? How did that happen?
They actually poisoned him with one of Marie Curie's discoveries, polonium, which is something Russia makes and uses for various industrial techniques. Why they did that, I'm a little confused. But that he's famous for being one of the only people murdered with polonium.
I'd love, actually, would you mind telling some of the sort of the breakdown of how Chernobyl went down? Because, I mean, that story was, I mean, when you describe each of these accidents, like Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima. I mean, it just really takes a real string of human incompetence. Like, a lot of people have to do a lot of things that are not standard procedure.
Well, Chernobyl was an amazing story because it started as a safety test.
Mm-hmm.
They too also had backup battery problems like what happened at Fukushima, and they wanted to see if they could use the leftover energy from the reactors to reboot the reactors. So originally the test was scheduled for a certain period, but all of a sudden there was a peak use of electricity, so they had to postpone it. And then the guy who came on, the workers who came on at that hour, weren't as familiar with doing the test as the people who were supposed to originally do it. And then the guy running the place kept making one bad decision after the next. So what happened was that when they powered it off, they couldn't get it going. So to get it back going, they amped it up too hard. And it would be sort of like hitting your gas on the car until your engine blew up. That's what they did.
My God.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing. They were doing it at 11:30 at night. The guy wanted to get home. You know, and you said the procedure was that when if they you know, shut down the reactor, essentially you had to wait 24 hours for it to reset.
Yeah.
And instead they're like, no, we'll just floor it right now.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So, I mean, that's the thing is it's not, you know, and even with Three Mile Island, I mean, some of the issues that went wrong there I thought were really, really interesting as well. Could you tell us a little bit about some of those?
Well, the remarkable thing at Three Mile Island was, in fact, that we still remember this as being this terrible... Here's my favorite part of Three Mile Island. Everyone in America remembers this as being a horrible accident. But in fact, the lesson of Three Mile Island was that that containment dome and the way it was made actually worked.
Mm-hmm.
No one was contaminated by Three Mile Island, but the industry and the government who regulates it are both so incompetent that that idea never got through the air.
I was going to say, they did a bad job of actually defending their case.
Exactly. So so the whole time now, we think of Three Mile Island as being this terrifying thing, and half of their stuff did melt down, but no one was infected at all, not even the employees.
Amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, there were certain things just in the design as well that I thought were really interesting, that essentially there was some sort of warning light that failed, and then by the time the warning light started going off, literally every single warning light goes off at the same time. So if you're a guy standing in the control room, you have no idea what the original issue is, and there's no ability to be able to respond to that effectively, right?
This is a stuck valve with with various warning lights, but people had so much trouble with their, I think there's something like 400 warning lights in the control booth. And they'd had problems before with the warning lights going on when nothing was wrong. So when this happened this time, they assumed that it was the warning light problem, not the valve problem.
Oh.
And then when someone finally figured out it was the valve problem and they fixed that, they thought that was the end of their troubles. But instead, this whole cascade started happening because the reactor overheated. And that set off this huge number of those 400 warning lamps to go on. And so they had no idea what to do.
How would a nuclear reactor today... a nuclear power plant today be different from the ones we built in the 70s?
Oh, well, there's a whole bunch of... the ones they're building today are pretty much the same, because, in fact, the fundamental American version of that power plant is safe. It's the one that's been used all this time in nuclear submarines without a single accident or a single problem.
Wow.
And it's a brilliant design of water-based... it's called a boiling water reactor, and the fundamental design is really perfect. But what I'm hoping is that one of the new technologies comes through and saves us and our energy needs. China is working on something called pebble bed, which is where the uranium fuel is encased inside its graphite so it can't melt down. And if anything goes wrong, the thing just shuts itself off and there's no meltdown potential. So I hope that works, because we got to get...
I like that.
We got to get China off of coal, you know.
Yeah.
Angeles right now is getting air pollution from China. So while everyone is worried about Fukushima on the beach in California, they need to worry more about the air pollution in China. So
that's right.
Bill Gates is funding something called a traveling water reactor, and the people working on this haven't released many details, so I don't know that much about it. And then we are still working on fusion, which is throwing atoms together and using the energy generated by their merger, which is how the sun works, instead of splitting atoms, which is fission. And they've been working on this forever, and many of us don't think it has much hope, but some people still hope.
But, there, I mean, you were saying that at the time your book went to press, there was a big step forward in fusion, right?
Well, there was a step forward in that they finally got a little more energy out of it than they were putting in. But we have spent something like $50 billion or something on trying to make this since 1955. It's been going on forever. But you're asking, the latest news from Fukushima is that they're trying to build an ice wall. They are going to be putting down piping around the entire location and filling it with coolant so that it basically freezes the ground so that nothing can leak out.
Wow, that sounds like a huge undertaking.
Yeah, well, they've already spent $1 billion in a billion yen, in cleanup, and it's not that cleaned up.
Because this thing is not going to cool down anytime soon.
No. they keep saying it has cooled down, but I don't think.
How
so.
Does water cool down a nuclear? Like, what is a water coolant? How does that work?
It doesn't. You can't use water. You use sand and borite and silicon and what's the other one? Cadmium.
But because there's two separate issues. There's the heat, and then there's the number of neutrons being given off, right? And the number of neutrons being given off is what sustains the nuclear reaction, and the heat is, you know, just a side product.
You have to smother it with neutron-absorbing materials like cadmium, and unless it gets inside the thing that's burning well enough, that can't happen. That's why it keeps burning.
Amazing. So, you know, I mean, I think that's the interesting thing is that, you know, we're really at a moment where we're going to have to decide, is the risk of a nuclear accident like Fukushima or Chernobyl worth offsetting all of those carbon emissions? Like, is that a price we're willing to pay?
Well, I personally would much rather live next to a nuclear plant than a coal plant. But at the same time, nuclear plants, you need public monies to finance the construction. You need it to subsidize the kilowatt rate, and you need it more public money if something goes wrong. Mm-hmm.
So that means you need to change the public perception, which is what your book does. And to a large extent, you've got to change the public perception of what radiation really is and what nuclear power is and just exactly how dangerous. The fact of the matter is that even though we've had a lot of meltdowns, very few people have actually died because of it.
Right. And, you know, I would much rather have more nuclear and less fracking as far as that goes.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's the sure. point is that it's the lesser of two evils statistically in terms of the number of people that died, but it's just so much more dramatic, like a Hollywood starlet.
Yes, exactly.
So that's the point is, you know, Lindsay Lohan, yes, she's a train wreck, but, you know, she's not doing that much damage to society. On the other hand, Kim Jong-un is secretly ruining the lives of millions of people and nobody pays attention.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a great book.
It really is. And I mean, the anecdotes in general, I mean, that's what I really appreciate about, you know, both Rocket Man and The Age of Radiance. And I'm going to read the rest of your books, too. But the anecdotes are so great. You do such a good job of finding, you know, I can't remember who it was who talked about le mot juste, or, you know, Mark Twain always used to talk about the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning bug and lightning.
that's great.
Good.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing. You find these perfect anecdotes that just so do such a good job. I mean, you're covering over 100 years of history, and yet you dial us so absolutely into the concerns, the mindset of that time period.
And the choices by these individual people. In writing, you know, about the sort of the people that, you know, gave birth to nuclear power, who was the one person that impressed you the most, if that's even possible to answer?
Oh, gee. I guess I have to say that I try to develop some kind of empathy with everyone I write about. And the one person I couldn't figure out how to get inside of and have empathy for was Edward Teller, who, you know, invented the hydrogen bomb and basically got Robert Oppenheimer's security clearance canceled because he was jealous. And then he wanted to use atomic weapons to frack, for fracking. So wouldn't that have been terrific? And then he's the one who got Ronald Reagan all excited about Star Wars. And to such an extent that when Reagan met Gorbachev and the two of them said, we can end nuclear weapons in our time, let's do it. When Reagan was told this plan would interfere with Star Wars, he backed out.
Wow.
So the one all-out villainous Iago character in the book is Ed Teller. And I really, you know, the one thing I tried to compensate for it by using one of his quotes, which is that he said that people have noticed how he and E.T. have more in common than just the initials. So he's a little Asperger's-y.
That's great. Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's not even, I mean, in reading the book, the sense that I got of Teller was not that he was malicious or that there was any sort of calculated plan. He just was sort of antsy and, you know, would get really indignant about things and would pick these causes and, you know, became, I mean, his ability to get an idea in his head. I mean, he held on to the idea of the super or the hydrogen bomb for so long until he could make it a reality.
And to make these long-term projects work, that's what you need. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, he was making these lists of his dream bomb. And my favorite Teller dream bomb was called the backyard bomb. And the backyard bomb was so huge and would kill so many people that you didn't need to take it and drop it on anyone. You could just set it off in your backyard.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
And that was pretty much the inspiration for Dr. Strangelove, right?
Yeah. Well, Strangelove is a fantastic combination of both Teller and von Braun. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if you know the photographer Ouija. Ouija was Austrian, and he was serving on the film as a consultant, and his accent was used by Peter Sellers.
Oh, that's wow. Amazing.
Wow. Right.
And then the other great thing is, if this is on TCM anytime soon, you've got to watch it. And instead of thinking of it as a wild comedy, think of it as a historic documentary, mm-hmm. because many of the things in it were based on actual things that he took out of books.
I just rewatched the movie. It's such
brilliant.
It's one of my favorite movies.
It's
maybe my top five favorite movies. Yeah. I mean, when George C. Scott is talking about we can't afford to have a mine shaft gap, sir. You know,
That was actually an idea of Herman Kahn, who was the big nuclear theorist at the time. He wanted the best of America to hide out in mine shafts with two women for every man to repopulate the world.
I like the idea. I'm listening. Yeah.
So much of his work was taken and used and said by Dr. Strangelove or by the general that he told Kubrick he wanted royalties, and Kubrick said, "Well, it doesn't work that way." Then all the time you see the head of the Soviet Union and the head of the United States on a hotline talking to each other. They did not have a hotline yet. That would come out about 6 months later during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Incredible.
The answer to the Cuban Missile Crisis. The communications between Washington and the Kremlin were sent by, wire, and then they were translated and decoded back and forth, and the whole crisis in Cuba was this delay in communication that happened between the two of them.
Well, you tell about basically that there was some telegram that was sent, and because the Soviet telegraph office was like having a bad day or something, you know, the telegram almost didn't get through, or it got through 6 hours late or something like that.
Yeah, many hours late. And then the entire ending of Dr. Strangelove, the automatic machine that sets off nuclear war that can't be stopped, the Soviets built that machine. During the Carter administration, they came up with a new theory called decapitation, where we weren't going to atomic bomb every single person in the Soviet Union, which was our original nuclear strategy. We were going to bomb the locations where we knew the Soviet leaders were. And the people who came up with this decapitation strategy decided to write about it in Foreign Affairs magazine. And when the Soviet leaders read this in Foreign Affairs magazine, they got very upset.
So what a surprise, yeah.
They created something called perimeter or dead hand, where if the Soviet Union is attacked by nuclear missiles and no one hears anything from the Kremlin, then an automatic series of commands will be sent for weapons to fly back out.
Yeah, the doomsday. The doomsday machine.
The doomsday machine came true 30 years later.
My God.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
It really is. It's, thank God for cooler heads prevailing. You know.
Well, but did they? I mean, you know, that's...
Well, they did. I mean, there was a command for one of the nuclear submarines to launch a strike, and he said no and went back... and saved,
McNamara, I mean, I think you quote McNamara in the book saying that it's not that, you know, we were smart, it's that we were lucky. Like, that's the only reason why the Cuban Missile Crisis didn't lead to nuclear annihilation.
Well, and the other crazy time that happened was NATO ran a very elaborate test called Able Archer that they ran in the 80s, and they even had a speech prepared for the Queen of England to give that they were under nuclear assault and all this stuff. And the Soviet KGB knew that certain elements they knew that NATO had a plan to attack them and disguise it as a test. Mm-hmm. And the more they saw this test, the more they were convinced that this would be them being attacked. And that's why that Korean airliner was brought down, because they thought they were under attack.
Wow.
From that Able Archer war games testing.
Wow. I didn't know that.
It's pretty amazing.
Well, I love the book, The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. Before we let you go... You are a man who writes about, you know, the Apollo mission, Thomas Paine, and then what got you to write about the Age of Radiance?
Well, I really like Rocket Man, this idea that you have this huge transformative thing happening in America, you know, to go from Sputnik, to go from being terrified by Sputnik to sending guys to the moon. And then the engineers and scientists behind all that aren't really written about as full-figured, full-blooded people. Mm-hmm. So bringing all that to life is a nice thing for me to do. It sort of gives me spiritual meaning to my work. And then when I started reading about these sort of details about what the public knew about the making of the atomic bomb, you know, it was basically Einstein and Oppenheimer wrote some formula on a blackboard and poof, bombs, you know. When I started looking into all this, and you know, at one point, the first 10 years I lived in New York, I lived in an Eastern European neighborhood. And when I was reading the standard biographies of Marie Curie, and it was all what a brainiac she was and so emotionless, and she was only interested in the facts, at a certain point I went, this doesn't sound like any Polish woman I ever met.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just started finding out all these things that were missing in the sort of educated Americans' knowledge of this topic.
Is there a profile for the great geniuses that, you know, you got Oppenheimer and Einstein and Curie and Enrico Fermi? They were all over the map as personalities, weren't they? I mean, a lot of them were Jews from Germany who were running away from persecution when Hitler started cracking down on that stuff. I mean, I think a couple of Jewish scientists had been assassinated.
And a surprising number of Hungarians were in the group.
That's my favorite wild story, is that who's your favorite Hungarian in the history of nuclear science? Because by this bizarre set of circumstances, a bunch of guys who grew up a couple of miles from each other in Budapest left Hungary over that country's anti-Semitism, got educated and jobs in physics in Germany, and then came to America because of Hitler. And almost the entire emphasis for moving to the atomic bomb was done by people who were first thinking, what if Adolf Hitler gets the atomic bomb and we don't have one? And Germany was the epicenter of scientific achievement in this time, and everyone assumed that they would be first in creating such a thing. And probably one of the saddest moments in the book is when one of the scientists at Los Alamos says, I knew that if we lost the war, it would be because we didn't do our job.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Man.
And you know, I mean, it's very interesting when you talk about the German nuclear effort, because, I mean, they were really undone by their own system. I mean, it was their anti-Semitism. It was their top-down hierarchy. I mean, all those things, that sort of their whole model of being was the reason why their nuclear program failed, wasn't
it? Well, also their entire economy was, you know, at the top of their economy were a lot of Jews. So one of the problems he ran into, Hitler, was like, if we round up all the Jews, my God, then we're not going to even know how to run the trains on time. I mean, there's going to be some issues, right? And so they had to pick and choose.
Exactly. And, you know, the woman who discovered fission, she was the first female university professor in the history of Germany. She was kicked out because her grandmother was Jewish. Her family hadn't even been practicing Jews for two generations. And she discovered fusion off in the forests of Sweden. You know,
God, so that's incredible.
They had the discovery of fusion, a vision in their own in Berlin, but kicked her out.
Amazing, man. Yeah. You know, yeah, we're Jewish, you don't like us. All right, we're going to America. We're going to invent a huge bomb
and blow the shit out of you.
Well, but really, it's almost, you know, that part of this book is really the war against the Jews, because you can almost look at it as before this exodus, America was a place that made telephones and the light bulb.
Right.
You know, we
right.
were engineering people. We still are engineering people. We're engineering people. But with the arrival of these emigres, we became the people that split atoms.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's such a pure example of, you know, those ideologies at work. You have America, which is based, you know, I mean, at our best moments on inclusivity, and then, you know, you have the Germans who are anti-Semites, and that's why they lost.
Well, Nazi morality has some work to do. I don't know. Yeah. It's a little bit of a bankrupt policy.
One of my favorite comments was my editor finished reading the book, and he calls me up and goes, "How could anyone not love Jews?"
That's right. I know. You mean a group of people that are incredibly innovative? You mean that put an emphasis on art and science and everything else? What are you talking about?
Yeah. Exactly.
The great
nerds.
Innovators.
Yeah.
Nerds. The great innovators, always on the outside looking in, telling us what's wrong. Stop shaking the boat, damn it. Come on now. Yeah, it's great. Well, Craig Nelson, thank you so much for doing the show. It's really a privilege to talk to somebody like yourself, and always a learning process. So thank
you. I'll come back anytime. This is a great show.
Oh,
yeah,
thanks,
so
man.
Much fun.
You're always welcome to.
Yeah.
We should get you back and talk about Rocket Man, because I know Hunter's
I would love to talk to you about Rocket Man. I'd love to talk to you about Thomas Bain. You may have to reread your own book, but you know.
I'd love to, man. Your books are great, and must reading, I think. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye now.
Thanks
bye-bye.
So much.
Craig Nelson, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, I mean, just such a great writer. Like,
what
a really, really
sweet man.
Yeah, absolutely.
He seems like such a sweet guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's why I love doing this show,
so,
ladies and gentlemen.
I think what we really learned is if you're going to hold a warm puppy, make sure it's actually a warm puppy rather than a big ball of plutonium.
That's what we learned today, ladies and gentlemen. And don't kick the Jews out of your country.
Yeah, that's
you're gonna
not
pay
sound
for
policy.
It. That's right. All right, this has been The Brian Callen. Who cares?
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.